Dear Mother, I pray you're not worrying after me, as I appear to be in good hands here. The Union Army is well rationed and in good spirits. We've all been issued new boots, and perhaps the most delicious coffee I've ever tasted. The Union has switched to spark plug coffee, which procures only premium Arabica beans and roasts them only when they're about to ship so that they can reach the men fresh and at its peak flavor. All their coffee is fair trade, so we can feel assured that they will be on our side of this ugly war. And the taste of their remarkable coffee raises morale as much as a sighting of Old Abe himself. When the war is over, I will surely become a loyal customer of Sparkplug Coffee, which is as easy as ordering coffee as we need it, or joining the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. And I have ascertained that, with the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word with the number 100, one can procure any size coffee order at a 10% discount. But listen to me, going on and on about coffee when the secessionists draw ever nearer. I hear the drums beating. I will write from Washington. And since I don't know when I will again get a chance to write you, Mother, please grant me this one wish and plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com. Love, your son, Beth.
You make a bad son. Better daughter.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, kiddies, and thank you oh so much for downloading the next 151 project, the Monday Morning Classic Movies Podcast. Our groundbreaking effort to talk about all 123 films on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists was checkmarked more than three NMs ago. So now we pick random movies and we dissect them. We make no bones about the fact that we are spoiling freaks. I'm the white savior who leads a suicidal charge on Fort Wagner, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady in the blue suit who loves the 54th. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
Would you die for the 54th?
I probably wouldn't have a choice if I was a member of the 54th. I don't think anybody survived.
Spoiler. Movie suggests that they all die, but I was reading that they don't all die, but most did. Because, of course, this movie is based on reality. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's film. Glory. Not the best title in the world. Pretty generic. Although that is said in the movie. Glory, hallelujah, when they all stay. When he thinks maybe they'll all bail when they find out what the stakes are.
And glory is the only thing they actually accomplish because the battle that they all die in wasn't a particularly successful one.
Massive failure. And they never do take that fort, Fort Wagner.
No, apparently that's not even true, though. I read that's an inconsistency in the film. In fact, they did eventually take the fort. It was an untrue title card at the end.
I think the movie suggests they didn't during that moment or those couple of days.
No.
Maybe years later they did.
What they accomplished was with the glory of their bravery, they influenced the army to continue allowing black recruits, and they recruited, I think it was like 180,000 black soldiers. We don't know if it turned the war, but I'm sure it helped for the Union.
Doesn't that say in this movie, title card also, that helped turn the tide of war?
When they recruited all those soldiers?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it was the recruitment of new soldiers that turned the war. It was their glory influencing the army to change their practices that turn the tide of the war, not that particular battle they died for no reason.
It was almost more of a PR stunt than it was. Like in Paths of Glory, so much of that is, well, that's a face-saving exercise, but that's more about politics than it is about actual war play, despite the fact there's some great battle scenes in both Paths of Glory and Glory. But in both cases, there are bigger issues than just actual fighting. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for Glory. 12 people have won Oscars in leading performances and also supporting performances. This is men and women. 7 of them won their supporting award before they won in a leading role. And that makes sense. You win the supporting award, then you eventually get the lead actor award. Denzel Washington, who won for Glory and also later for Training Day, is one of those. Name the other 6.
So in no order that makes any sense, Kevin Spacey, first won for The Usual Suspects, and then 4 years later won for American Beauty. Jessica Lange won for Tootsie, and then later for Blue Sky. Robert De Niro won for Best Supporting in Godfather Part 2, and then Best Actor in Raging Bull. Cate Blanchett, first with The Aviator, where she played Katharine Hepburn, and then later in her amazing performance in Blue Jasmine. Jack Lemmon, first won for Mr. Roberts, and then many years later for Save the Tiger. And last but not least, Meryl Streep won for Kramer vs. Kramer before she won for Sophie's Choice. And then again for The Iron Lady.
Right. And Denzel did break a streak. Not really a streak, I guess, but he was only the second ever supporting actor winner after Louis Gossett Jr. in 82, so earlier that decade at least. And four times since, there's been a black guy winning the award. Twice Mahershala Ali in more recent years. Cuba Gooding Jr., of course, also. And Morgan Freeman, for that matter, who's in this movie, who won for a movie that Chris and I covered not long ago, Million Dollar Baby. But at this point, we had seen very few black winners of any kinds of awards, especially in this category, Louis Gossett and then Denzel. And Denzel was the right choice. It's one of those awards you could name other people that year who were very worthy, but Denzel is fantastic. I think you'll probably agree, but we'll get to that in a few minutes. Before we do that, Glory was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists, just like Rocky Horror Picture Show a couple weeks ago. But obviously it didn't make those lists because we wouldn't be talking about it now. It was first released by TriStar 30 years ago in mid-December 1989. Didn't set records, but it wasn't a bust either. Bev, you better describe this 30-year-old movie with the glory. Skinny.
Matthew Broderick is Colonel Robert Gould Shaw, a young officer in the Civil War who was promoted to command the first all-black regiment of the Union Army. His troops, who include Denzel Washington as Private Tripp and Morgan Freeman as Sergeant Major Rollins, come from a variety of backgrounds and have different approaches to army life. They fight racism and the Confederacy and prove themselves to be phenomenal heroes.
Or, in a nutshell, black men get shot for coming near a white man's house. I actually was going to say something like, black lives don't really matter. Oh. But that would have sounded bad, so I didn't go with that one. Although I'm saying it now.
You said it anyway.
Well, at this time, they sure as hell didn't. They were starting to matter more because they were allowed to be in the army. A big reason why this movie exists, I guess, is to show what they did at Fort Wagner, but to also show that they were just a PR stunt for so long, including just being in uniform, the blue suit, but not actually doing anything relevant. And one of the first things they do when they are actually put into any kind of battle is they have to sack a town, Montgomery, not the Montgomery from World War II, the British colonel, but this other guy. And I was reading about him. Apparently, he wasn't as vile as he's portrayed in this film. Okay, we'll get into the story in just a minute, but that reminds me of something I've said in other times in this podcast about war films. It's shitty what they do. And that whole sequence, he shoots a black guy for assaulting a white woman, even though he's basically prodding the guy to do it, and he says the N-word and get your hands off her. So that's shitty. And then when he tells everybody, including Broderick, to just go ahead and sack the town, shitty, but we're in war. War as hell. Maybe they go too far. Obviously, you shouldn't be raping people. We just watched Game of Thrones a few days ago.
I was
ago.
Just going to say, you sound like someone who's on Team Daenerys.
By the
right
time
now.
This airs, that show will be over. But as we record this, it's not over yet. But you see soldiers and other people, I guess, just murdering people in King's Landing. Platoon has a sequence where guys are at least trying to rape a young girl, and Charlie Sheen stops it. I'm not saying any of that's cool, but I always question this notion of, well, fight, kill, but wait, no, do it nicely.
Well, you're just supposed to fight, kill other soldiers. That's not an unreasonable request, and I'm pretty sure that there have been pacts and treaties based on exactly that and defining what is and isn't a war crime.
I just find it odd, the morality of killing everybody on the other side, but doing it the way that we tell you to do it. This movie does portray it in a way that's pretty hard to object to that, though. I just wanted to bring that up because I've said it in other films, and I don't want to be inconsistent and not acknowledge the fact that it's war, and then I'm saying that Clifty Young, as Montgomery, is portrayed as a bad guy, but maybe in war, maybe he's not.
We continue to disagree about this. I'm not naive enough to think that this kind of thing doesn't happen in every single war just because simply the opportunity for cruelty will breed cruelty. But that doesn't mean that it's not a bad guy thing to do.
We're all bad in war, I guess, which has also been shown in Game of Thrones. Okay, the glory numbers. 93% of critics and audiences, the same number, like this movie. 38 fresh critics and 3 rotten critics, the average of 7.86 out of 10, which is not too shabby. And it was 45th at the 1989 U.S. box office. Batman was number 1. Driving Miss Daisy, we covered a couple months ago, was number 8. And When Harry Met Sally, we covered quite a few years ago, was number 11. That's a weird foursome of films. Although Morgan Freeman is in 2 of those. Of course, Driving Miss Daisy and this one, Glory. So anyway, after all this time, what did you think of this movie? Which I know we watched not that long ago, maybe about a year ago. And I think that was your first viewing. So this is your second. What did you think of the film this time?
I think I liked it better the second time around. It's just, in general, not my jam. I don't really dig war movies. And I find the Civil War in particular not all that interesting and something that gets covered way more than I would like. Though battle scenes are phenomenal, they're actually so exceptional and wonderful. And even though it's fair to accuse this movie of being a white savior film, I think it's way better than most white savior films. I think it does a pretty good job of creating interesting, eclectic black characters and letting their perspective shine through. I would say it's not so much a white savior film as like a white cipher film. It's a white perspective film of a black story, which was probably only the case because Shaw was the one who wrote the letters that they wanted to base it on, but probably more so that studios were simply afraid to let black characters lead a movie.
Which is still true today, but that's slowly changing, we hope, anyway. I think the other thing you have to note about this movie is that it's based on reality, and that was, of course, the truth. You're not going to put a black person in charge as a colonel of a regiment in the Civil War.
Yeah, but you don't need to tell a war story from the perspective of the white colonel.
You don't need to, but this was the reality of it. If we don't acknowledge that the colonel was white and his top lieutenant, the Cary Elwes character, is also white. Although Morgan Freeman is made sergeant major, in fact, and that's a pretty big deal. They have a whole scene where they're on a boat. And it's a bit of a PR stunt, but it's also a legit thing. He's not just doing this for PR. It's partly for that. I think Shaw's always aware of the politics of what he's doing and the visuals of what he's doing. Rollins deserves it, too, at the same time. Rollins is the one who doesn't save him, but finds him early on in the film after Shaw's been in a battle at Antietam, where he does turn tail. He gets shot, granted.
I think the movie is suggesting that he's acting cowardly.
But he turns tail, exactly. He lays down, and I guess he does actually pass out because he seems to wake up. It's not like it's just pretending to be asleep, or out of it, at least. But then he looks up and sees Rollins with this halo around his hat as if he's this Jesus character. And what a turn. This movie's all about character arcs. And what a turn for Shaw, because at the end, he's the one trying to charge into Fort Wagner. Come on, 54! First, the guy with the flag gets shot and drops down, and Shaw keeps charging ahead and gets shot for it. It's one of the great moments in movies. Well, we'll talk about the greatest moment in this whole movie that follows that. But one thing I gotta criticize about that moment is that their colonel's telling them to come on twice. First, the guy with the flag, he's trying to pull him up, and then that dude gets shot and falls down. But then he keeps on going, and nobody reacts until he's been shot, and then, of course, Tripp does react. One of those things, kind of like the mountain, and again, Game of Thrones, I talked about this before, when they showed the zombie to Cersei in that big meeting a couple years ago, season 7, why doesn't the mountain react when it comes right for her and almost gets to her? Well, same thing. Why aren't they reacting when the colonel's saying, let's go, charge, more than once? But it is a good arc for him. It is a good arc for Denzel. There's a good arc for Andrea Brower. Morgan Freeman actually is one of the only ones who doesn't have much of an arc. Or I guess even Cary Elwes. Maybe a little bit for Elwes, but Freeman is kind of just going along the same way he always was. He's a pretty good dude in the beginning. He's got more power, but he's about the same dude in the end.
The arc, I guess, is him getting rewarded for good work and for his stoicism and good soldierness.
I do like that the last shot, not the last shot of the whole movie, but the last shot of the battle is Freeman and Elwes. The two, I guess, top lieutenants after their colonel's been killed outside the gates of Fort Wagner, side by side. The other guys are part of that too. Well, not Tripp, because he's been shot dead. But everyone else in their group, regiment, battalion, whatever the hell it is, have charged ahead. They've made it to the top of the gates, and then they're all shot and killed. Kind of a tragic moment, but in this movie, as we've said before, it's all about the fact that they tried. The writer of this movie, Kevin Jarr, J-A-R-R-E, I think it's just pronounced Jarr like he would J-A-R, he plays the guy who says, give him hell, 54! Who earlier in the film had battled a little bit and almost got in a fist fight with Denzel Washington and other guys.
The other soldier.
I love that moment. I think that's a great moment, paying tribute to these guys who are walking to certain death.
And again, that is their great accomplishment. They changed hearts and minds. Crazy things happen in war, but nothing is crazier to me than the fact that the Union Army would have resisted taking advantage of hundreds of thousands of soldiers.
Of able-bodied men.
What an outrageous decision that you would have had to waffle about it, that you would have had to do a test and see how it goes before you just commit. As the movie points out, their fears were that these soldiers would be cowards, would be unruly, would just simply not be as good as white soldiers. And of course, they proved to be the complete opposite, and I wouldn't dare speculate why.
I can.
Well, they're used to taking orders.
Which is what you have to learn in the military. We've talked about that in other war films, that effectively you have to become a robot. That's a line in Full Metal Jacket a couple years before this film, that the military doesn't want robots, but really they do. They want robots that will do what they want and have humanity at the same point, which is awfully hard to combine. But they want people that are going to fight for the cause, are going to believe in the cause. These guys have so much to lose.
And so much to gain as well.
Well, yeah, the reason why Shaw says glory hallelujah is when he finds out that everyone stayed, including the Cary Elwes character, Cabot Forbes, who could have just as easily left. Any of them could have left because Shaw gives them that chance. If officers are captured by the Confederates, then they will be killed. They're in big trouble. And the black men, who may be free or maybe not, but they're going to be slaves all over again, or even just flat out killed.
Yeah.
And nobody leaves. Another great moment in this movie, which was very appropriately on the top 100 cheers list. It was 31st. It's Wonderful Life was number one. And I love It's Wonderful Life, but this movie is probably more inspirational and more important in big ways. That movie, It's Wonderful Life, was always about how one man can make a difference in a small town. Well, here are a bunch of guys who made a difference over the course of many years in an entire country by standing up and fighting back, and also fighting with white soldiers, but more importantly, fighting for their own cause and giving the entire divided American country a reason to think, all right, well, we should include them too.
And just for $10 a month.
$10, a lot of money.
Well, $13 is what everybody else was getting paid.
That's a nice scene too. It's a bit of a war cliche that they bond over the lousy pay, but the tear it up scene is pretty powerful. And then everyone does it. Broderick starts it, and then everyone does it. But of course, that is actually, I think, the first scene that Denzel has after he's been whipped, when he's the one telling everybody, this isn't right, we're only getting paid this amount of money. I'm not worried about a travel that they got paid less than everyone else, but I guess they somehow found out.
I feel like gossip probably travels pretty fast in the army. People just share information pretty openly. Something of an irony that these soldiers fought for equal pay when black men still to this day have a massive pay disparity across the board. People make a big deal about the women's pay gap, and they should, but the average white woman still makes more than her black male counterpart in 2019. Yeah. Oh. And even worse when you look at Hispanic. The lowest paid person in America is a Hispanic woman. And it is a very bad disparity. It's like 55 cents on the dollar or something. My point being, this movie's trying to show progress. It's not like that changed the world. It's not like when you look back at that and say, how racist? Well, it's still happening.
Okay, the movie has a running theme. You covered it in your coffee sponsor there with the voiceover through letters from Shaw to his mother. This movie is based on those letters and also books, two separate ones, in fact, by Lincoln Kirstein or Kirstein and Peter Burchard. So all those things, the letters, the books. And the letters motif is also used in Edward Zwick, the director, Edward Zwick, we haven't said his name yet, of Legends of the Fall, which he did 5 years after this movie. Another movie I liked an awful lot when I saw it in the theater. I didn't see Glory in the theater, but I remember seeing Legends of the Fall and thinking it was fantastic. It's a little bit silly in its way, but it was the follow-up. No, maybe Zwick made something else, but it was the next big movie he made after Glory. And then he made Courage Under Fire, which we've talked about a few times in this podcast, which I think is an underrated modern war film.
I haven't seen it, but it's another film that's about a black soldier, right?
Denzel's in that too.
Oh, no kidding.
He's investigating whether or not Meg Ryan's character would be the first woman ever to get the Medal of Honor. And it's a Rashomon story about what really happened when Matt Damon, Meg Ryan, Lou Diamond Phillips, and a couple other people are pinned down and under fire after a helicopter crash in Iraq. The first Iraq war, though. So he's made some important movies. He's also a producer, as Wick is, a couple years after this, almost 10 years after this, on Shakespeare in Love. And I think we talked about that during Shakespeare in Love last year, that Harvey Weinstein was not a fan of his for whatever reason and bullied him out of things and whatnot. He is on the stage and got his Oscar that night. The only Oscars Wick has is for producing a movie he didn't even direct. And yet he directed three movies I love, Glory, Courage Under Fire, and Legends of the Fall. And I haven't seen it since it came out in the theater, but Last Samurai, for all of its faults, another white savior film, that one maybe a little more so,
notoriously,
was at least well made in a committed performance by Tom Cruise. One thing that's really important about this movie is that it sets the tone, just like Saving Private Ryan does, which was about 9 years later, but it sets the tone in the first battle where we see a guy's head just get exploded. Great editing, great example of how you set the fact that this guy's in front of Shaw and you cut, and of course it's just some dummy with explosives in its head. Wham! The head is gone from a cannon shot. Cary Elwes is part of this too, and they're all just marching blindly ahead, which I guess was war back then, maybe even now. Cannon fire, shots going at them, and they just keep on very slowly going ahead. Unlike in the end battle of this movie where it's charge and they're running at least. But in the first battle at Antietam, just walking.
That's what they were trained to do, was just keep your pace, keep walking towards the gunfire. And that's exactly what they did until the point where he gets hurt and backs off. But that battle scene is a great example of, I think, one of the things this movie does best, and that is that the battle scenes are phenomenal. They're so exciting. You feel like you're really there. The violence is visceral and in your face. Even if it's somebody's head blowing up right in front of you, I don't know, it just feels like that's how it would really happen. I think a lot of credit goes to all of the actors' performances because Matthew Broderick is performing fear. Hey, I have a question for you. There was a lot of criticism for Matthew Broderick being cast in this part. I want to know what you think about that.
I think he is actually a little miscast, but I think in a good way, maybe.
Yeah, it
because
has to be intentional.
The character is miscast.
Yes.
Sorry, the real guy, meaning Shaw.
Yes.
He survived the Battle of Antietam, and because he has influential parents, he's made a colonel of what is a PR stunt with the Black Regiment, the Black Battalion, whatever you
want to
call it.
They give him a job that probably nobody wants. Nobody would want to be the colonel of the Black Regiment. So they're like, okay, we'll give it to this guy who's not qualified, but he'll have to say yes because his parents aren't just influential, but they are abolitionists. So he, on principle, would have to say yes to it. But he's not ready. That seems pretty evident to me. They don't beat you over the head with it, but I think people who think he's miscast are missing the point that he's supposed to look like a little boy out of his element.
Because he wasn't that many years after Ferris Bueller's Day Off, still his most famous role. We covered him in Election, which was about, 10 years after this movie, where he also seems still like a bit of a man-child, which also works for that role, as did his looks and everything else in You Can Count on Me. Broderick hasn't been a big star since the 80s, I guess. Maybe his looks worked against him because he still, even now, doesn't look that much like a grown man in some ways.
Well, he's done a lot of theater, too. I think he's more committed to his Broadway.
And he made a fortune doing the producers on Broadway. In this movie, at least, it worked for him that he looks like a kid. And he also, as you pointed out, is a white man who's failing up. And he's promoted right in front of Frederick Douglass.
Another reason he can't say no. Nobody would want this job. So they arrange it in a way that he can't say no.
And they weren't supposed to go into battle anyway, because it is a long time before they actually go into battle. They train for a long time, and they're doing PR stunts, and they're just the black people in the blue suit. Look what we're doing, this token gesture for these people. Well, it took a while before they finally got a chance to prove themselves. We talked about the brutal battles. But when they have their first real head-to-head fight in the woods, where Tripp proves himself the first time, big time, they all do, but especially Tripp, and that's when Shaw wants to make him his color guard, which is weird, because give Tripp a gun, don't give him a flag. But anyway, in that battle, it reminds me of a great war film, which not enough people have seen or talked about, We Were Soldiers. And Sam Elliott, who is Mel Gibson's right-hand man in that movie, says at one point when the Vietnamese are about to come down on the Americans, which of course is the Vietnam War in the 60s, gentlemen, prepare to defend yourselves. Because he's saying, they're coming at us, get your bayonets ready. Well, that's what they would have had, I guess, in the Civil War. They don't say that in this movie, but this is not going to be shooting from a distance anymore. This is hand-to-hand combat, and they have to use the move that is shown by the drill sergeant earlier in the film, which does another payoff because Andre Brower does use that in the big battle at the end. He also goes nuts, that war whoop kind of thing he gives off, when earlier in the film he couldn't actually make that work against the drill sergeant, who, by the way, this is one thing I find a little disingenuous. This movie does use the N-word, but the drill sergeant, he would most certainly call them the N-word instead of black bastards.
I don't really know. I don't know how that word was.
He would have.
How was that word understood to be used back then? Did they really consider it the gross insult that we consider it today?
It was so common that, of course, he would have used that word. The only reason he wouldn't have is that because this is supposed to be that we're giving black people the chance to rise up, you can't insult them at the same time. And that's certainly not what Shaw and Forbes are doing. But their drill sergeant?
Well, I was just going to say, drill sergeants probably are still using that word.
That's my point.
They want to belittle and destroy them.
Just like maybe this has changed because the way the world has changed, but they probably still use faggot and whatnot as well, or gay slurs and all this kind of shit. Just like athletes do, undoubtedly, even now, despite this whole, we're all woke now, I doubt it.
So something with this film, and like a lot of war films that I find so alienating, is that they are consistently upset that they are being kept away from the action, that they're just being stuck in manual labor. Not like I would love doing manual labor either, but I would certainly prefer manual labor to the front lines where people are getting shot at and stabbed and losing legs and dying of infections. Why do people want to do that? You have to respect that that's where they want to be, and they're upset that they're not being put in harm's way. Maybe it's the chicken in me. I just have never understood that about soldiers.
Most war films have, especially more modern war films, and this is effectively modern, 30 years ago, it's not that long ago, they don't want to go into battle. A lot of the great war films have the characters complaining about what they're about to do, like Saving Private Ryan, who where they're bitching, why are we doing this? And that's a movie set in World War II, also not that long after the Civil War.
A great movie about that is Jarhead, where they never do see action. They very much do want to be put in harm's way. They want to kill people. That's part of it. I think people sometimes join the army because they want to commit violence.
Those characters also train forever in that movie. That's a huge sequence. There's a montage, and I think they show up many times. They train and train and train and train and train and drink water, but then don't actually do anything. There's four men to a tent. Now, I wonder if that was typical in the Civil War or if that's just a racist thing because they're black. We also do learn about Denzel Washington's character, Morgan Freeman's, Andre Brower, and we haven't said his name yet, but I guess it's pronounced Jimmy, or maybe it's Jamie, but J-I-H-M-I Kennedy. He wasn't in very many movies. He's Schartz. He's the one that has a great salute. He's the one who stutters as well.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
And there's that scene where he's bullied when he's showing off his shooting prowess, and Shaw comes along, faster, faster, faster! It's mean, but it's necessary.
Yeah, that's...
Train them properly, Major, which is what he says to Forbes. And Shaw's not wrong. Okay, it's a moment, they're just having a little bit of fun. But if you're going to train these guys, train them properly. But those four guys are in the tent, and we also see the kid with the drum, the mute kid. I wonder if that's typical of the Civil War or anything in this era, having four guys in a little tent, or if it's because they had dark skin.
Again, I feel like that probably still happens to soldiers on the regular, that their living conditions are very cramped. The movie does a really excellent job of making them very distinct, very interesting characters, and all of them different. They bring different backgrounds, different perspectives. They have different reactions and motives for everything. It's hard in any war movie to tell the soldiers apart, but especially hard here because most of these actors were unknown at the time this movie came out. I mean, it's easy for us to tell Morgan Freeman and Denzel Washington from the crowd, but they do such an excellent job of not letting them get lost in the uniform and kind of disappear.
I know you're saying, though, war films get into that. Saving Private Ryan, even. I don't know if this is based on reality, but you see it in other war movies where the captain, Tom Hanks in Saving Private Ryan, has those two little bars on his helmet. I think to make sure we know for sure that's Tom Hanks. Even he can be hard to distinguish in a movie that makes it hard to see things deliberately sometimes, Saving Private Ryan. This movie, too. Now you've got black guys, or if it's all white people. Either way, if everyone looks basically the same, it's hard to determine who's who. This isn't about race. It's more about their faces are not that different. So mostly black people, mostly white people. I think that's part of the whole point of a war movie, though,
Look at Dunkirk. Dunkirk failed miserably.
I just saw that again recently. I still don't know who the fuck anybody is in that movie.
Yeah.
And
terrible job.
Terrifically technical war film and really well done. Kenneth Branagh's got a great role in that as their commanding officer, their Shaw, effectively. But the movie does fail on making it clear who anybody is. And I guess maybe that's not the point of it. But this one does have great arcs for all the characters. The best character, of course, is Denzel Washington's Trip. He's got so many classic moments. The feet we see when he needs shoes. His feet are... How is he walking on those? I know he's tough. He is one tough SOB, but still. And of course, the most famous scene he has in the movie. Well, I'll get to my favorite scene later. But I guess the one that people talk about is the whipping. And that's what they did to people who were called deserters. He wasn't actually a deserter. He was just trying to get some shoes. Yeah. But that's what they said he was, a deserter.
It's pretty satisfying to see a soldier look straight at our sympathetic commander and force him to reckon with the rather ironic punishment of whipping an already scarred up black man. I'm glad he's hard on Shaw. As far as he's concerned, he's right to give him a hard time. As far as we're concerned, he's right to give him a hard time. Later, Shaw learns that the reason was because he didn't have boots, which is another inaccuracy. Apparently, the soldiers were all given uniforms and shoes on the day that they enlisted.
Which they should have been. But that tear he lets go, the one single tear, actors can do that, I couldn't do that, I'd be a blubbery mess. But that is one of the moments in this movie that won him the Oscar. That did, along with his speech where he says, I love the 54th, when they're doing the, oh my Lord, 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 Lord. There's a great song. Why wasn't that nominated for the Top 100 Songs list? That anthem or hymn or whatever the hell it was from probably black slaves, I guess.
Well, it's a great example of them exhibiting black culture. Even though all these people come from different backgrounds, they do seem to share a culture that alienates Shaw and the other officers. He writes about it in his letters. It's one of the VOs. He's like, they just seem to have their own world. They have their own songs. They have their own way of practicing Christianity. He feels very separate from it, as if they're foreigners. I thought that was a really interesting observation that they go on to explore, especially in that scene, which is a pretty wonderful scene. You know they're going on a suicide mission.
And they do too.
They're just having this moment of camaraderie beforehand, and it feels really authentic, and it's important to see them in that moment. It's like the film shifts from the white characters at the beginning, and then by the end, you really are focusing on the soldiers themselves and their experience. It's a really immersive scene. There's a lot of close-ups. The sound design is really beautiful. They've got the fire so that it's lit in the way that you can only see their faces. You can't really see their surroundings. It's a really intimate moment, and it's well done.
It's just for the black soldiers to have that. You know, another reason why the white guy is leading this movie is that Matthew Broderick was coming off of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which was, I think even then, acknowledged as an 80s classic. And Denzel and Morgan Freeman, despite their Oscar nominations, because Freeman had been nominated for Street Smart in 87, I think against Denzel, ironically. Broderick was the star of all of them. Cary always had been in Princess Bride, was becoming a star.
But that's because they cast a star, because they wrote a script where the white man was the star of the film.
But when you have this cast, Broderick is the big star, so he's going to get more scenes. But I think you're right, that at the end, he has plenty of moments, but then he doesn't even make it into the fort. And the only white guy that does, that we really see anyway, is Cary Elwes' character, who is right beside all these black guys. He's not necessarily leading the charge, and he's not saying, come on, boys. Maybe a little bit, he's waving a sword. Literally, he and Freeman are side by side, and their commanding officer's already been killed.
And he's just as dedicated to the cause at that point as his soldiers, with and their kind of death wish.
The build-up to that is just great. There's so many excellent parts of that whole scene. Apparently a different colonel asked, who will lift the flag and carry on if this man should fall? And that's when Thomas, Andre Brower's character, comes forward and says, I will, even though he's injured. Now, one of the great arcs is that Denzel's always given Brower a hard time through the whole movie, and then towards the end, when Brower can barely stand, Denzel studies him. You're cool? You're good?
Hmm.
So they have their little conclusion of their arc, because Denzel never respects him and has always given him a hard time that he is an Uncle Tom, but by the end, he doesn't actually charge forward, because then it leads to my favorite moment in this whole movie. Wow. We've talked before about guys you'd follow into battle. Broderick in this movie, maybe, but when he shot dead, the music in that sequence too, but he's dead. Everyone looks, what do we do now? And it's Denzel, who had refused to do this exact same thing in an earlier scene. Okay, that's cinematic cliche maybe, but it's also powerful when you do it the way they do, which is jump forward, come on! That look alone, Oscar.
What do you make of the character of Trip? You said he has the best arc in the film, probably the best character, certainly just the most fun to watch. Maybe fun isn't the right word, but his passion comes through and is really infectious and brings so much of the energy to the film. I get a little confused why he enlisted at all, because he seems to have so much animosity towards the army, certainly towards his commanders, and even towards his fellow soldiers, who he picks on and bullies and questions their reason for being there, questions them for following orders, just basically doing their jobs. And it really does call into question, what are you doing here?
Thomas's reasons are more pure, and so are Rollins's reasons. Rollins talks about why he's there. He's the one that gets all over Trip for calling people the N-word, and the only N-word here is you.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the whole point of his character is that maybe kind of like Kane, I always think of this movie because Scorsese talked about it in the AFI special, the original one that started this whole AFI list thing that got us to make this podcast, where Scorsese says about Kane, you don't know him. And sometimes some of the great characters in movies, you don't really learn that much about them.
Mm.
So maybe we don't need to learn that much about Trip. But he goes from being this antagonistic dick in the beginning of the film, understandable, obviously, because we see he's been whipped. That's probably why that scene exists as much as anything else, is to prove he's already been through this, man. He's already fought for a cause to begin with. Whatever he did wrong, he probably didn't deserve that. Now you're going to whip him all over again. And then he's recovering from that for days because he's laying there in the hospital. And his back is completely messed up now.
Along with his feet, which are also recovered.
Which already were messed up, yeah.
Denzel Washington is probably one of the most charismatic actors in Hollywood. But so much of his charisma is about that underlying rage. There's always something about him that you're a little bit afraid of. All that energy actually comes from an anger right under the surface.
I have a note here, ferocity.
Yeah, that's actually a
for
really
this performance,
perfect way to describe it.
And maybe any movie. His other Oscar, Training Day, has a lot of ferocity.
Yeah. But now, everything, every part he plays, Malcolm X, certainly his motives came so much from anger.
That should have been his first leading actor Oscar.
Because he's so excellent in that movie. Mm-hmm. You love him. You want him to win. You want him to root for him, but you wouldn't want to be on his bad side. Wouldn't want to be there when that facade, or not facade, but when it cracks. And that anger comes out. You're always a little bit afraid of him.
Maybe he's better cast as an aging assassin, tough guy, kill everybody character in the Equalizer movies. Even more so than Liam Neeson or some of those other guys who are aging and getting those kinds of roles.
All
those
late middle-aged action hero roles.
Real thing the last 10 or so years. We didn't even meet Denzel until 18 minutes into the movie. He's truly a supporting character, but I do fucking love that moment at the end. That, come on! I watched it again when I was setting up the page for the website before we even recorded this podcast. I've seen that clip on YouTube or in the movie itself dozens of times. It's so powerful. But before that, when they're all standing on the beach waiting to charge ahead, there's a nice payoff as well. The various times that Shaw refuses to fraternize with Thomas pays off when, I will. I'll see you in the fort, Thomas. Even though they all know that's not going to happen. We're not, by the way, using the Matthew Broderick Boston accent, which is okay, I guess. He isn't really drawing it out in the car.
Well, they probably didn't talk like that during Civil War times.
No, okay.
Accent probably wasn't that extreme at that point just yet. Plus, he was a member of the upper class. That's the working class accent.
Fair. That's true. So when they all charge forward and you get all the sound and fury, Apocalypse Now-esque, great technicals. Edward Zwick did some of the same things in Legends of the Fall when we see World War I happening. Brad Pitt, Aidan Quinn, and I forget their little brother right now, who is E.T. Henry Thomas, who plays their brother when they go into battle. Some of the same kinds of visuals. This movie did win the cinematography Oscars. It should have. I think that movie won as well. But in that last battle, they went down standing up. Reminds me of that line in Shania Twain's song, I'd rather die standing than live on my knees.
Our great poet laureate.
Shania Twain.
The mayor of Canada, Shania Twain.
And at the end, this is based on reality. I was reading that Shaw was buried with his men, and that was a contemptuous act by the Confederates, because officers were usually buried separately. And I was reading this really nice story. I never read this before. Maybe it was a new edition on the IMDb, where his parents went down to visit his grave at some point, years later, I guess. And someone said, do you want us to dig him up and let you have the bones to bury him up in Boston? That'd be hard to do amongst some other people, but that's the idea. And they said, no, he's with his men, where he'd want to be in the first place. I thought that was really touching.
They really walked the walk.
We talked about most of the actors here. One of the ones we didn't talk about was his mother, Jane Alexander, who was in All the President's Men and also Kramer vs. Kramer. Pretty well-known actress by that point. Not a star, but she'd been in some good movies, and she's mostly cut out. I guess there was a lot of preamble going into the film. The movie's about 2 hours, and I think it probably would have been more like 2.5 hours had there been more of her. Sorry to say to Jane Alexander, but I don't think she's really all that missed. It's more about the men. It's more about Broderick and his soldiers. And a lot of Elway's scenes were cut, too. So it's not just about cutting out the mother. It's also about cutting out a guy who is always with them. Mm. Whenever we see Broderick, we mostly see Elway's, and most of his stuff was gone, too. Well, not most, but a lot of it was gone, too, apparently.
I'm not interested in those character stories anyways. They don't prove to be even close to the most interesting characters in the movie.
Richard Reel plays that prick who won't give the supplies over, and finally, that's a nice scene, actually. That's a fun one. Bob Gunton's a corrupt general. He was the warden at Shawshank Redemption. And then Jay Sanders is the righteous General Strong, who is the one, apparently, I think it was supposed to be his character, that actually asked, who will lift the flag and carry on if your flagman goes down? And it was apparently Shaw who said, I will, rather than a regular recruit.
As for the quartermaster, I'm glad this movie doesn't let the North off the hook for being racist. They may do the bare minimum and oppose literal slavery, but they're just fine with treating black soldiers like third-class citizens, black people.
Not that much has changed in so many parts of the world, including
and
America.
And the North is racist, too. It's not just the South that has problems with racism.
Our country has problems with it, too.
Yeah. Canada is not innocent, although we have a pretty good reputation that is not always deserved.
So Edward Zwick, we talked about his credits already. He was worried that a black cast would object to a white director, but apparently they didn't, and they got along pretty well. He worked with Denzel, again, like I said, in Courage Under Fire. Maybe they should have been a black director. Spike Lee didn't speak up. I guess he didn't have the power to do that then, like he did on Malcolm X, and he bullied off Norman Jewison for making that movie. And Spike Lee was the right choice to make that film in the end. But Zwick wasn't necessarily making a movie about the cause, I don't think. He probably recognized what he was doing, but it was more just this great story.
I think it's impressive that in 1989 he would even question his validity as a director of a film like this. In 2019, that's obviously a conversation that we have and people think about it, but in 1989, that actually feels like a pretty progressive way to think, to question whether you belong on the film or not. And Spike Lee, this is the year that Do the Right Thing came out, so he didn't really have any influence when this movie was getting
made. It's pretty telling that neither of these movies were nominated for Best Picture in a year where Driving Miss Daisy won Best Picture. Oh. The racial picture that Driving Miss Daisy was. Born on the 4th of July would have been a great choice to win that award. Terrific war film, which does have some racial elements, but mostly about Vietnam and Tom Cruise's great arc, maybe his best performance. But Do the Right Thing and Glory should have been nominated for Best Picture also. There are some scripts in this movie, and people have probably noticed this before if they've seen this movie a few times. There's a watch on one of the kids' wrists when they're all waving. Morgan Freeman says to them, that's right, black man wearing the suit, whatever his line is, and then they walk off and then everyone's waving.
It's a digital watch, too.
Really stands out. And then also, despite the fact it leads into the best moment of the whole movie seconds later, but when Broderick goes down, you see a squib cable coming out because he is the one who sets off the squibs. This is what was supposed to happen to Willem Dafoe in his most famous moment in the platoon when he does the Jesus pose, but nothing comes out of his body. He's supposed to be getting hit by bullets. He's supposed to blow a squib too. If you look closely in that scene, a great scene that it is, he's holding something in his left hand because he's supposed to be blowing squibs but isn't doing it. And Broderick has a cable coming up his legs. Maybe he wasn't blowing the squibs. I guess maybe someone else was doing it, but that's how they work. It was coming up to the pant leg. Now you can do it digitally, or you just get rid of that cord coming out of his legs. We talked about Kevin Jarre already writing the screenplay. And then Freddie Fields was the producer. This was his final film. He only made 12 movies in total. He was a talent agent, though. I think mostly is how he got into producing movies. Freddie Francis was a cinematographer. He won 2 Oscars, including for this movie. Also shot Cape Fear and The Straight Story. Worked with David Lynch a few times. Also did The Elephant Man before any of that. And the Blu-ray that we have, the Sharp 4K Blu-ray, is 1.85:1, so it fills your TV screen nicely. They talk online about how Zwick and Francis tried to avoid blue skies, but I noticed there are plenty of them, especially in the last battle, before it gets to be nighttime, of course.
Why would you avoid blue skies anyway?
To give it a bleak beauty. It's all about how we're in these great parts of America. They're in the south for a huge part of the movie. Of course, their training is up north in Massachusetts or wherever they're supposed to be. But then they go down south and they talk about how hot they are, where likely you're going to have more blue skies and nice days and that kind of deal. But it says online you don't see the blue sky, but you do plenty of times. Sometimes online people are just flat out wrong. The editor, Steven Rosenblum, who's his Zwick guy, cut a lot of his films. Also Braveheart and X-Men. So he's cut some big time movies in the 80s and 90s and whatnot. I guess he's still working now. And then the composer, who I thought did a great job, James Horner. Same year did Field of Dreams, which Chris and I covered not that long ago for scoring at the movies. Titanic, which won Oscars, including for him. And the score, I just mentioned Braveheart, the cutter, Steven Rosenblum. Horner was the composer for Braveheart also, and I noticed how similar this score is to that one. And I always loved the Braveheart score, but watching this movie again this time, I'm thinking, man, just like John Williams and so many other great composers, you really do rip yourself off an awful lot, dude. I don't know if that last bit of music, I think it is, was classical, but when we were watching the end credits, you went to the washroom, I just sat there and watched the end credits. I'm trying to see where it says classical composer. I can't even do the music, but that bit at the end where they're charging ahead and then they all get killed with that cannon fire at the very end when Broderick's already dead and the last guys are charging ahead. If that was a Horner original, and I don't think it is, it seems like it's classical music, but I did not see a credit for Beethoven or Mozart or whoever. But if that was a Horner original, then why wasn't this movie nominated for the score? And it wasn't. But I guess you didn't like it because you're not a big fan of huge scores and whatnot.
The battle, the passion, a big score, totally appropriate, blanketed almost wall to wall, violin reminded you when to feel feels. Not as much. It's not that I hate score as much as score is pathologically overused.
What do you think about the cutting and the cinematography?
It's technically amazing. This film is a really technically great film.
There were real explosions on the set, and they were obviously controlled, but still very loud, and then the movie did win the Sound Oscar, which seems pretty appropriate. This movie and Born on the 4th of July won some of the big technicals that year, the war films of 1989. That was a good year for films, and they really divide up the Oscars, and they gave the wrong ones to Driving Miss Daisy. Glory won 3 Oscars, supporting actor for Denzel, and the second time ever for a supporting actor Oscar winner who was black. The cinematography by Francis and the sound. It was nominated for the editing and the sets, but did not win those awards. I mentioned already it was on the Cheers list, and it was nominated for the Top 100 Thrills, the Top 100 Genres in the Epic category, the Top 50 Heroes, Trip, and the Top 25 Music Scores. All right, so on the American Memorial Day, we talk about Glory here in honor of soldiers who have died. This movie certainly pays a lot of tribute to those people, certainly in the Civil War. It's an unusual film, especially at that time. We'd not seen a ton of Civil War movies that talked about the black soldiers and what they went through. So wrap it all up, what'd you think of Glory at the end here?
Like I said at the beginning, it's not necessarily my jam, my kind of movie, but if I was a history teacher with a hangover, I would be very happy to show this to my students. They could have so easily leaned on cliches and manipulation, but I think instead they gave us a movie that feels really authentic and moving. It's better than I expected it to be. I like it better than I thought I would.
And you said you liked it more the second time.
And I did like it more the second time.
It's probably true of me too. I think I liked this movie plenty the first time, but I've liked it more. Maybe not every single time I've seen it, but there's so much powerful stuff in this, and watching some of those clips really pays off. The actors mostly bring it, and Broderick, it works if he's miscast, yeah. But the black actors, Denzel, Freeman, Kennedy, Brower especially, this is his first movie. And then the older white guys, who were cast very well in their small roles, being dicks, inappropriately. Although maybe it could have even been more savage with the language than it was. So that's one thing I think maybe they did pull back a little bit. But they do use the N-word, at least. They're not being completely dishonest. Because people back then, even now, but back then especially, just casually said that kind of thing to people as if it was like saying, Mister. Okay, when we return in 7 days, we'll change it up and cover a fun sci-fi comedy romp. Huge change of pace here. Men in Black. And that's because Men in Black International comes out on June 14th. And that is directed by F. Gary Gray. So here is the coming attractions trivia. F. Gary Gray directs Men in Black International, so that's the fourth Men in Black film. He directed another sequel to a Barry Sonnenfeld flick before. What was it? And, bonus, in both cases, Gray's sequel reunited stars from a previous unrelated movie. Who are they?
So for the answer to that question, check out our next podcast about Men in Black. But if you just can't wait until then, well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or Spotify,
Stitcher!
Where you can find us now.
Yes. Finally!
Yes, we finally figured it out. We put our brains together. Wait, no, we didn't. You did it all. Figured out how to get our podcast out there to you, no matter where you'd like to listen to your podcast. You can check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered almost 300 movies now, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. And all those episodes are available for you for free. But perhaps in exchange while you're there, you could give us a rating and a review. That means a lot to us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive.
I want to pay tribute to Denzel Washington's great moment, but I don't want to blow up the mic, so hang on. Let me do it over here. Come on!
And cut.